I push it again, and we believe that it's recording now. Okay. Course information. There's information up now about both your papers and the final exam. What shall I start with? On the oral reports. Of course, we're having our fabulous oral reports, half of them, next week. Now, I see how many of you here right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. Hey, folks, we're way short of what we should be. Oh, well, we'll see what happens next week. Hope those of you who are teachers, that your students never get to see something like this. Bad example. I put up a template for your papers, which if it's not difficult to do or a problem, I would like you to use, where I have it set up already so that we all have the same format, and by golly, even the same font, if that's all right. If it's too much of a technical difficulty, if you've already started doing your paper and you have it formatted and so forth, if it's too much trouble, don't do it. Yeah.
It's up there.
Was it the writing guide that you put up?
No, that's been up there from the beginning.
Yeah, because I was going to say I've already finished.
You've already finished.
Yeah.
Well, then don't worry about it.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
I followed your writing guide.
Writing guide is fine. So it's just a matter, yes, if you aren't anywhere near that far, go ahead and do it. I should have had it up earlier. Anyway, it'll be up there, and it'll be, let's see, your last name in capitals, but only as an acronym. And then your first name in small letters, also as an acronym. And then it'll say BW for Baroque World, and we'll have the semester and year. Okay, so that's the name of the document, and I have it in four different formats. I believe they're read-only, so you will need to save them as the new document. And of course, for YLNIC, there you put in your last name in capitals. And then where it says the other thing, you substitute your first name. I think it's your first initial or something like that. Okay? And then the rest of it. Okay? And you save it as that. So I have it set up so where you put the title, where you put these various other things. It's my practice now to have people do the bibliography right after the title page. There's a title page, then there's a bibliography, but don't worry about it. And then there is the text that you write. If it's convenient, go ahead and use that. Now, what I've said is, and this is new, that the due date for, let's see now, I think I say the putative due date is next week, but I've said Saturday. Saturday of next week, not Saturday of this week, if you get it in before. Now, that's the due date for the electronic version. I would like to get from you both an electronic version and a hard copy. This is just so. I prefer working on electronic versions, but just to make doubly sure that there isn't something that goes wrong and confusion resulting with an electronic sending, that you also give me a hard copy. Hard copies, as I say, should not include images. That is to say, don't waste your ink on that. But images are fine if you have them in the electronic version. Okay? Now, let's see. What did that get us to? Yes. So, electronic version. This is up there, too, the due date I've got up on Blackboard. The electronic version then would be due Saturday of next week, which is whenever that is. I think that's still
May 2nd.
That's May 2nd. Thank you. And the hard copy, I would say, would be Wednesday of the 15th week, which will be May 6th, possibly. Wednesday, May 6th. Now, these are flexible dates. That is to say, if you have a problem with either one of those and you talk to me or better, email me about them, and then, you know, we can work out something else. If those precise dates are not good for you. All right. Now, I do await with anticipation your images. Let me remind you that you should think of your little mini talks next week and week after as being really 5 minutes. Think of 5 minutes. And so you want to squeeze all our pleasure and so forth up into one ball. If nothing else, think of it in terms of not relaying everything that you had to say about a particular subject, but how this is an important aspect of the Baroque that we've left out, or if not that, how this fits in beautifully with all the things that we've been talking about, or something of this sort. So bring out one or two really, really big points that you think are important, and that either fit in very well with the course or aspects that, of the period that we haven't dealt with very much. Okay. Very important. Yes, the final. So I'm thinking, and when I say I'm thinking, I mean this is it. This will be it. It will be a take-home exam, which is to say it'll be a send-to-me exam. And I will provide you with the questions. And in a sense, I have the questions already. But I don't have them down on Blackboard. But there's going to be one long sort of thought, philosophical question. Well, it was sort of a philosophical nature, or a theme, a philosophical theme that goes through a bunch of our different people. And that'll be probably the biggest one. Then I'm expecting there to be a dramatic one and a fine arts or performing arts one. For which your various, very nice, the readings that we've done will be important. I may be putting up specific texts that I particularly want you to look at and have in your minds. I have gone through the Pascal, the letters, not the letters, but the pensée, yet again, the selection I've done for you, and I've done a yet more select selection. That is up somewhere in the folder on the final exam. And there may be other things that I put up and say specifically, I expect you to be handy, especially with this text that we've done. Okay, so that's it for right now. Questions? Yes, sir.
Is there any idea when the final will be due?
Yes, and that is on Blackboard. So what I said was it would be due, that is, you send it in to me electronically, and that's the only form I need. The night of the final exam, when the final exam would have been, which would be Wednesday of exam week, and that's May, whatever it is. Again, there is some flexibility if there are special problems with a particular due date. And that's all I know. Yes, sir.
Pictures for the presentation, is there a specific day or time that you need them on?
The sooner the better.
Okay.
And I would say the day before at the latest. Now, and remember, you have a limit of three, what would admit about to three pages, or that I could put on three pages, well, of course, without getting things real small, because
right.
You know, I like things to be really big. so, and don't send me PowerPoints. I'll rip them to pieces if you do, electronically. All right. Is that okay? Yes, ma'am. Okay, is there another alternative to
instead
what?
Just sending separate images, that would be sending several images, you just send it in a Word document?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, if it's something that I can reassemble, that's the thing. Because I'm going to put it all together into one thing is my idea, unless I change my mind about that. Yeah, okay. All righty. We welcome once again Professor Robert Scott Dupree, who will be talking to us about one of his many interests areas of expertise, namely Baroque music. And so here we go.
Oh. Before I begin, I should clarify something. I'm not an opera buff. Opera buffs are sort of like sports buffs. You know, they worry about runs batted in and batting averages and all of that. And opera buffs worry about the high C's and the high B's depending on whether or not you're talking about a soprano or a tenor, and so on and so forth. But I do find the topic of opera interesting because it helps us to define absolutely what we mean by Baroque music. So what I'm going to do this evening is show you how this period from 1600 to 1750, which is the general limit given it by musicologists and historians of music, how this is defined by the growth of and development of totally new musical forms that hadn't existed before. Now, please work. You suppose it wants the keyboard? Does this do anything? Oh, that's right. I'm not viewing, am I? Forgot to do that. For some reason or another, For some reason or another, the computer refused to recognize my final version of this. So I'll have to improvise again. No matter how hard I try, something always thwarts me. But that's okay. We'll survive. Okay. What I'm going to do here is give you the third installment of a theme that I started in my first lecture. As to say, if you remember, and perhaps I won't be too surprised if you don't, we talked about city planning and urban design, and part of that was the intersection between stage on the one hand and city. The city is stage, the city is theater, and then the theater is representation of the city. Now, as it happens, two of the important 16th century architects and urban designers, Antonio Palladio and Sebastiano Serlio, were important names in the development of the theater. And we'll see how that came about. So to begin with, this is the Teatro Olimpico in Vicenza. This is one of the rare examples of a surviving 16th century theater. You can visit it in Vicenza today. I last saw it in 2001. As you can tell from the stage, low battery. Oh, goody. That's all right.
Low battery for what?
Oh, for the mouse.
Want me to go get some batteries?
Let's wait and see what happens.
Okay.
I can always figure out an alternative of one kind or another. Maybe. Who knows? So here is the stage of the Teatro Olimpico. Its stage set was designed by another architect and designer, Scamozzi. You'll notice that there are three openings here, and this is typical of not so much the Renaissance stage, but the classical stage. That is to say, this entire theater was mapped after a number of Roman theaters that Palladio had visited. And so this is meant to suggest an ancient theater, though it's indoors, and ancient theaters were indoors. But you can barely see up at the top there is a sky. Well, the sky is, of course, a make-believe sky. And it doesn't render too well here, but as a matter of fact, let's see, is this where the lights are?
Those are some of the lights that you don't have complete control.
Does that help? It doesn't help you much, does it? No, that doesn't help you at all.
You want the front lights?
There
you go.
So I'm afraid the slide doesn't render this very well, but there's a sky up there on the roof, and you'll notice that there is a stage, and you notice this area here, which in an ancient theater is called the orchestra, and which gives its name to what we call the orchestra. In other words, the instrumental ensemble that sits right here takes its name from the theater. So from the beginning, we can see that the theater contributes to a concept of music in this period. Here is a look at the Via Regia, that is to say the main street, which you see through the archways, and it's quite an illusionistic street. You can see the sky out here as well, see it a little better, but it continues over the roof line as though in the theater we are outside. So there's this inside-outside play going on. Now, the Teatro Olimpico was finished in 1581 or thereabouts. Palladio died at about the same time, so he just lived long enough to finish it, to design it. If you go down this street to the end, here's what you see. Notice the way these arches are very close together. They give the impression of a great distance, but in fact, the street is only a few feet long. It's not very long at all. And here's a detail of one of the sides. You can see it's entirely made of wood. This, by the way, held a lantern or a gas lantern, and that's the way the theater was lit on the inside. This is the back of the set. Looks very different when you're looking at the back. And here you can see the sky. You can see it a little bit better here. Here is the sky that reaches all the way through the auditorium. Now, what's interesting about this theater is that in 1585, it was inaugurated with a performance of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex. Now you get a premiere, because there is no recording of this music that we're going to hear in a minute. They invited the main organist at St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice to set four of the five choral odes in the Oedipus Rex. And in a sense, this is one of the beginnings of opera. So this is the first time that a classical drama was presented in a modern language, translated into a modern language. And the Academy, the Olympian Academy, from which the theater gets its name, the Olympic Academy, it was a group of scholars who were interested then in pursuing the Renaissance humanistic goal of restoring antiquity. Now, this was also performed in the last year of Andrea Gabrieli's life, and we'll have more about him in a minute. This is a monochrome fresco that depicts a scene from the performance. And it's rather interesting to note that, by the way, Oedipus and the other characters, here's the stage that we saw. Here's the audience out in the hall. Here's the upper level of the seating. There are classical statues here in columns. All looks very antique. And, come on, play.
Thank you.
You may have noticed some strange things here. One is that I didn't have access to a choir, so I had to use a synthesizer to produce the voices. But more interesting than that, which is, of course, surely a circumstance of my limited resources, is that this music doesn't sound like anything else in the 16th century, or for that matter, anything else that follows. It's totally unique. It was a complete reimagining of what a tragic chorus might sound like. For those of you who remember Oedipus Rex, this is the first chorus, and you'll notice that he alternates between the solo speaker, or singer in this case, and the whole chorus of nine who sing in unison, well, not in unison actually, in four parts, but sometimes only two people sing, sometimes three, sometimes four parts. And so there's a bit of variation in all of this. Now, nobody knew what Greek music in the classical period sounded like at this time. And so they had to reinvent it. And this reinvention, then, is the origin of opera. This is where it comes from.
Were they trying to emulate what they thought it would sound like, or did they just kind of know that they were?
No, they knew they didn't know what it sounded like. But here's what they had done. Oh, come on now. Give me the next slide. Go to slide. Not sure I know which one this is. Let's see.
14.
Thank you very much. Okay. But let me answer your question first. No, they didn't think. They knew, certainly, that it didn't sound anything like this. What they had read was Plato and Aristotle and Theophrastus and other ancient philosophers and authors who had said a lot of things about the character of music. And if you read at least some of the readings I asked you to look at, and I don't know, were you able to view the videos for the most part? Okay. We'll get back to this in a minute. Plato and Aristotle and others spoke about the affect of music. They said that certain scales caused you to react in certain ways, that music could make you feel in certain ways. Some music made you want to go out and fight. Some music was lascivious. It made you lustful. Some music was calming, and so on and so forth. And they were very impressed with the power of music, as recounted in antiquity. Now, as it happens, this music, then, was something that they knew they hadn't experienced in their own period. That is to say, polyphonic music, which is complex, which weaves voices together. Often you can't really understand the text unless you know it in advance. The voices overlap and so on and so forth. And in fact, at the Council of Trent from 1550 on, during this series of reformations of the church in Rome, there were various motions that were established to change church music so that the text, the sacred text, was more comprehensible, more intelligible. And so there were a number of simplifications that were brought into motion then in the second half of the 16th century to accomplish this. One of, and by the way, it was the great composer Palestrina who showed that you could retain polyphony, but use it in such a way that it was still possible to hear and understand the words. Well, this is not connected, by the way, with the Teatro Olimpico group, or the Accademia Olimpica, which is in Vicenza, and therefore a bit northwest of Venice. But over in Florence, there was a group of men who had been interested in something else. And this is the Intermedii. And the Intermedii were a series of court entertainments. And in my later version of this PowerPoint presentation, which the computer refuses to acknowledge as a PowerPoint presentation, I have some more information. So maybe I'll put that online. I'll have to strip out the music or you'll never be able to get it to run, but I can do that. So the intermedial, or plural intermedii, were a series of entertainments that went back to, as early as the early 15th century. These were dances, songs. They were inserted as entertainments between various courses and meals at banquets. These would be noble banquets or royal banquets. They were inserted during various celebrations, for example, royal weddings, or when there were great affairs of state, when there were visiting ambassadors, for example, they would have these entertainments then to sort of break up the formal ceremonies. And ultimately, they worked into plays. Now, by the mid-16th century in Italy, various dukes got interested in things antique, and they would have performances, for example, of ancient plays in their original language. This was sort of dull for the Duchess, who didn't know Latin or Greek, and the entertainments, the intermedii, that is, these little plays that were inserted between the acts of the serious play, then were greeted with great relief by the ladies and the not so well educated or the not so fascinated by classical antiquity. So there began this practice of having entertainment within the entertainment, interludes as it were. Gradually these gained a kind of momentum, and you began to get, oddly enough, something like a sort of play in between the acts of the play. And this lasted all the way to the 18th century they were doing this. Matter of fact, you'd have the main play and then these little skit-like or dance and song routines that would go in between them. Now, I mentioned that this is the third of three lectures that are interlinked. And you recall that in England, we had the mask. Well, the mask is exactly the same thing as an intermedio, except given an English face. And in France, there was another version, which is called the ballet de cour, the court ballet. The court ballet was introduced into France, again, about the 1550s. You remember there were a lot of French queens who were Italians and who came from the Medicis. And so with Catherine de' Medici, for example, in the 1550s, we begin this interest in Italian entertainments. But by 1581, and lo and behold, this is, of course, the same year as the Teatro Olimpico. So on the one side, we see this interest in reproducing classical antiquity, but you've got to reinterpret it. You have to recreate it. It's the remake, as it were. At the same time, you have developing the ballet de cour in France. And here, the music is important, of course, and the text in these things is not terribly coherent. That is to say, at least for quite a long time, the interludes between acts, interlude, ludus means play, interplay. The interludes were not connected at all. They were on different themes, very often comic or allegorical in character. Well, the ballet de cour was very similar to this, but in 1581, a certain Italian whose name was Bellogioia, but whose name was Frenchified into bourgeoisieux, from Bello Gioioso, bourgeoisieux, created a, well, in this case, ballet de cour, that was called the Ballet of the Queen, but it was based on the story of Circe. And he had the clever idea then of creating a ballet that had a coherent story based on a classical text. And Bourgeoisieux also thought that in some sense he was recreating ancient drama. Okay. Oh, by the way, at the end of the Ballet de Cour in France, the nobles all joined together in a dance. So the audience became part of the entire spectacle. And speaking of spectacle, the interludes, the intermedii in Italy, the interludes in England, and the ballet de cour in France got more and more spectacular. So that Bourgeoisieux had at his command 400 artists and craftsmen. Now that was unusual, but you can imagine that a lot of money was spent on it. I've already mentioned that a lot of money was spent on the masks during the time of James I. All right, so these are lavish affairs. And it is this very lavishness ultimately that will work its way into opera. But we'll see that in a minute. Now we take another step and go back a bit to the end of the 15th century. And there is another dramatic tradition, and that is something called the pastoral drama. This is a form of play that has some dancing and song in it, but that is mainly an attempt to depict a kind of golden age when life was simple, when people were, shall we say, less sophisticated, but also perhaps lived more innocent lives than they do now. And in 1471, in the court at Mantua, a poet by the name of Angelo Poliziano, and I'm sorry, it's not on the screen here, but it's Poliziano, one of the major poets of the period, wrote a pastoral play called The Fable of Orfeo. And this was the first attempt to use a classical motif in a play in a modern language. So 90 years before the Oedipus Rex, which is a translation, not a new play, but a translation of the original Greek, Poliziano had done a play called The Fable of Orpheus. And Orpheus, in this play, is associated with shepherds, and we'll see that in the operas as well. There are lots of shepherds around. He's a shepherd, as a matter of fact, although he's a demigod, so he's a demigod shepherd. Hard to know, but, well, okay, you understand what's going on here. There is an allusion to the good shepherd, in part, and this was not the first time that this had come about. This is one of the other aspects that made the classical figure of the shepherd interesting. So Poliziano's Orfeo, we know, had song and dance attached to it, but we don't have any of the music. We do have the text. And a number of years ago, Paul Van Nevel, who has a Renaissance group that used to perform these things, made a CD in which he used contemporary music to set the whole thing and try to recreate at least the atmosphere that might have been the one surrounding the fable of Orpheus. Now, why Orpheus? Well, because Orpheus, number one, is the most famous of the mythological poets. He was the man who lost his beloved Eurydice and who went to Hades, managed to charm Charon and the gods of the underworld with his singing. And this allowed him then to persuade them. After persuading the rocks and the demons and all the rest, he persuades Hades himself to allow him to bring his wife back into the upper world, back to life. And he is allowed to do so, but he's told he must not look back at her until they reach daylight. And unfortunately, Eurydice wonders why he won't look at her. And finally, after she begs him and tells him he doesn't care about her anymore, is it because I'm dead, you know, this sort of thing, he looks back, and of course, she immediately is pulled back into the depths of the underworld. And he goes out and becomes a misogynist, strangely enough, and a woman hater. And ultimately, he is torn apart by a crowd of bacchants, or maenads, some wild behaving women. And his head floats down the river singing. And he is made ultimately into a god. Now, if you think about this for a minute, and if you look at the essay by Bardi that I gave you an excerpt from, you may put two and two together here, because though Bardi had nothing to do with the Teatro Olimpico, he did have a lot to do with the intermedio performances. In fact, he was a sort of producer of court intermediate. And in 1581, then he put on a very expensive and very complicated and lavish intermedio. And there were several performers in it who were to play a role a little bit later in some activities that he organized. He got interested, along with a man named Jacopo Corsi, in investigating ancient Greek music. And so they wrote treatises, and they entered into correspondence with learned men in different parts of Italy, and began to work on this notion of reviving, not real Greek music, of course, but the spirit of Greek music. What they had to draw on was a tradition of popular song, interestingly enough, secular popular song, which was a simple use of a single or maybe two voices, but usually a single voice accompanied by a musical instrument, usually something like a lute. And this gets us eventually into the whole question of instruments, but I'll get to that next with a brief look at the difference between the Teatro Olimpico, which is meant to be a classical theater, right? The Greek and Roman theaters had, or the Roman theaters anyway, had permanent sets. And these were sets that could be used for tragic or comic scenes. They had different streets for comedies and for tragedies, interestingly enough. But they were fixed sets. On the other hand, the intermedio was not usually performed in a theater, but in a large hall. And so they had to bring in all the sets and the stage materials. And these were sometimes quite elaborate, but they were temporary. Now, as we move into the 16th century, we begin to get theaters that use more and more spectacular sets. In other words, we begin to create permanent theaters that use the style of spectacle associated with the intermedio. So here's Troy burning. And by the way, this would not be a backdrop. You have to understand that. These are smoke and flames and buildings burning and toppling, like the one on the left, and people running everywhere for cover. So you can see that this stage, this theater, is a very different one from the Teatro Olimpico. And this is the kind of proscenium theater that will become typical of the opera theaters, but also of other theaters as well, because the first opera theaters were not built for operas at all. They were regular theaters that were taken over by opera companies. So you have a curtain, and you have very elaborate sets. Now here is an example. This is actually from an opera. And we have the gods up here. And this, again, is not a backdrop. We've got horses and all of this. And you notice that this is very perspectival. But let's look at the machinery behind this. This is a set that was created by the greatest. This is a vast wooden machine with lots of cranks and pulleys. And by turning these cranks, they could cause these great, this wheel that's got all of those gods around it, they can make it descend to the stage or rise up into the heavens. And they can move all of these other things. These were absolutely amazing to the audiences. And this is what the audiences wanted, as a matter of fact. By the time of the first Venetian opera, or rather the first opera performed in Venice in 1636, this is an itinerant company that organized itself. They came from Rome originally, and they hired local musicians and others and performed an opera in that year. The very next year, they decided that they were so successful that they organized a Venetian opera troupe. And from there on, opera was settled in Venice. And by the way, not only was Venice changed by opera, but opera was changed by Venice. But I'm getting a little ahead of us here. All right, so this is elaborate and, as you might imagine, expensive sets to produce. So Torelli, not to be confused with a musician at the end of the 17th century, Giuseppe Torelli, this is Giovanni Torelli, Giacomo Torelli, sorry. This Torelli ended up later in France in 1645, and there he created the set for the first opera scene in France. 1597 now. This is a conspicuous year. First of all, the successor to Andrea Gabrieli, who did set the choruses for Oedipus, his nephew and student and disciple, Giovanni Gabrieli, who ultimately succeeded to his uncle's place at St. Mark's, and therefore who had the most prestigious musical position in Venice, published his Sacre Sinfonie. And this is now going to get us another step towards the ultimate shift in 1750 to the symphony orchestra. And in that very year, the first opera, Daphne, was created by Ottavio Rinuccini and Jacopo, it should be, I misspelled. It's J-A-C-O-P-O, Jacopo Peri, as part of the celebration of the wedding of King Henri IV of France and Marie de' Medici of Florence. Another Medici. Oh, by the way, it was a proxy marriage, so Henry IV wasn't there. And these things went on for days. But first, let's look at Giovanni Gabrieli. He and his uncle were fairly prolific composers. And you have to understand that St. Mark's had two organs facing one another on either side of the main aisle of the church. They're still there. And they used these for double choirs, so they'd have a choir and an organist in each one of these, and they could do antiphonal effects. And St. Mark's is very reverberant, so it produces a magnificent sound. The Sacre Symphoniae, or sacred symphonies, are not symphonies in our sense at all. Symphony, of course, simply means a playing together, sounding together in Greek. Gabrieli, in 1585, remember again, that was the year his uncle composed the strange music for Oedipus Rex, Giovanni Gabrieli published a collection of music he had written for St. Mark's, where he was second organist while his uncle was alive. And this was called Sonate Pianoforte. That is, sonatas, soft and loud. And this is significant because, first of all, it's the first time in written music that we get indications that the musician should play now soft and now loud. So before that, you had no indication of loudness or softness. This is a new effect, as it were, that's specified. The composer is deliberate about it. And it's all tied up with this notion that music is meant to stir your emotions in certain ways. So music is becoming rhetorical. At the same time as Bardi and his group, who met in a chamber at his house, and therefore they were called the camerata, that is, the meeting room fellows, the camerata, they also were looking for ways to recover the miraculous effects that Greek music had on the emotions and on their listeners. So this is another stage. But perhaps even more significant than that, the setup of St. Mark's meant that you had at least two groups of singers and instruments. So this is Giovanni Gabrieli, and this is the Sacre Symphoniae. Oh, sonata, by the way, is another word that's going to have quite a history, a subsequent history. Sonata means sounded or played, a musical piece that is played. And you say, well, aren't musical pieces played? But it refers to instruments, ultimately. So a sonata is a composition, though you sometimes find it used in the early part of this period for voices and instruments. Mostly it means for instruments alone. And this is the other interesting thing that is beginning to happen in this period. Throughout the 16th century, then we found the emergence of instrumental music. Because for centuries and centuries, and continuing all the way up to 1750, which is our cutoff date in more ways than one, people thought of the voice as being the greatest musical instrument and the model for all other instruments. But, and therefore, if you had instruments, they were to support the voices. Suppose you've got a four-part piece and you don't have a tenor. Darn, those tenors, they're so hard to find. You've got a bass or baritone, you've got a soprano and an alto, but no tenor. But you've got a trombonist. So he'll play the tenor part. And sometimes you just have one singer. You have a soprano or an alto or somebody, or just a tenor. So the other parts can be covered by instruments, and so on and so forth. Well, in this instance, now, Giovanni Gabrieli is a very important composer. So was his uncle, Andrea, in the growth of instrumental music. You see him there with his lute, and he's composing evidently because there's a pen and a manuscript down there below him. Now I'm going to play you one of his greatest works. It's In Ecclesiis, in the assemblies. The text is from the Old Testament. It's a motet, that is to say, a piece that's based on a religious text, but not one that is part of the religious service, normally. All right, so a setting of a religious text, a motet. And this goes all the way back to the Middle Ages, and there's not time to explain all the history of that, but that's what it is. And motets continue well on through the Baroque. So it's his most complex. And it wasn't published until 1615, but it was written, of course, and performed before that. There are four groups plus continual organ and string bass. Now, what is continual? Towards the end of the 16th century, we start to get a separating off of the bass as accompaniment, the continuous bass, which you might say becomes more and more the foundation. So if you've got four singers, you have a bass or sometimes a keyboard instrument that originally would play all the parts that the singers were singing and then might play an octave lower than the bass to give it a kind of foundation. Well, as you begin to isolate the solo voice more and more, you begin to get this continual or continuous bass then as a kind of way of establishing a steady beat. Sort of like jazz, as a matter of fact, the way that the bass establishes a steady beat in jazz. And by the way, there are a lot of resemblances between jazz and Baroque music. And I started out playing Dixieland jazz when I was 12 years old. And the transition to Baroque seems very natural because, first of all, in both Baroque music and in jazz, you improvise a lot, as we'll see later if there's time. All right, so you'll notice there are four groups. Group one is singers in four parts. Group two is another a chorus, and that too is an interesting division, soloist and chorus. We're going to find that structure in another musical form, the oratorio later on, and the cantata perhaps, but mainly in the oratorio. And then we have group three, which is a group of instruments playing, and I'll explain in a minute what a cornet is because I brought one with me. Anybody ever play the cornet in high school band or anything? No. You know what that is when we refer to it? No. Looks like a trumpet, but it sounds a little different from a trumpet, or it should, it doesn't always. Then finally, group four is a violin, a viol, and two trombones here, I think. And then the organ and a string bass. Okay, what does that sound like? Now, I have, as is my wont, I put the score in here, but you'll have a little trouble seeing the score when everybody's singing and playing at once because there's not enough resolution in videos to make it stand out. Come on now. Now you notice we have a soloist. Soloist and the choir. Now watch what happens. A different soloist. Notice it's very easy to understand the words. Now, all the soloists, the choir and the soloist together, and the instruments, you hear the organ continuo. And now, in contrast, the instruments play, the cornetti play this dotted rhythm, and we have the two cornetti as soloists. Notice all this ornate ornamentation of the notes, contrasting whole ensemble, loud, soloist, soft. Two soloists. Notice how there are no two parts of this that are quite alike. There's a constant run of contrast, and this is very, very typical of Baroque music. And this is an early manifestation of it. You see this in the art, you see it in the literature, and you hear it in the music. Voices and instruments together. The soloist singing, pianoforte, soft and loud. Soloist in a marvelous sort of tangle of sounds, followed by this block, a massive sound. cutoffs there. So, impressive music, to be sure. And certainly an innovation that will have many, many implications. One of which is this division of instruments and voices into different groups. Now, you have to understand that as instrumental music began to emerge in the 16th century, that is, there was always instrumental music, but it began to take on a life of its own, instruments tended to be in families. So now I'm going to turn the lights on for a minute. Also so you can see. What does a cornetto look like? Looks like this.
I'll get more light.
Thanks.
Yeah, you'll probably need it.
It's a wooden tube. I've made a few of these. One of my hobbies is making musical instruments. And it's carved out of a piece of wood. You saw it in half this way. And you use a chisel, and you shape a tapered internal track on each side of that. Then you glue them back together, and then you drill holes, and then you turn a mouthpiece on a lathe. I didn't make this one, by the way. I've given away all the ones I've made. I have to make another one someday. This is the devil to play, but there were incredible virtuosi in this period. The cornetto was played all the way up through the Baroque. You get it in Bach's church music, for example. But the last cornetto player anybody ever reports was around in a village somewhere in Germany in 1810. And that was the last anybody had ever heard of one. The instrument was revived in the 20th century. And I've had the pleasure of meeting some of the leading cornetto players in the world about 14 years ago, I went to a conference of the early brass society, and it was sort of like an Olympia of brass musicians. Now, this instrument is extraordinarily hard to control, but you can play a lot of notes on one breath if you're good at it. Anybody in the house play a brass instrument ever? Nobody at all? Oh, okay. Well, brass instruments have a mouthpiece here, and the sound is produced by buzzing like that into it. And this sound is then contained by the mouthpiece, fed through a tiny hole in the bottom of the mouthpiece, and then it's amplified as it comes out the ever-widening core on the inside, the bore. This will probably not sound too good because, by the way, I have not played this instrument for a very long time. Doesn't sound like a trumpet, does it? Now, you've doubtless heard a lot of Renaissance and Baroque brass music, and you hear it all the time at graduations and weddings and all of this. But the cornetto's place is taken by the modern trumpet. All right? The modern trumpet is a totally different instrument. I happen to have one here. And we've got a whole bunch of mouthpieces. Let's see, which one is the modern trumpet piece? There's one. Okay. One of the reasons this thing is so hard to control, look at the difference in size between this mouthpiece and a trumpet mouthpiece. Also, trumpet mouthpiece has a nice flat rim here to cushion your lips. This has a sharp edge around it. There are lots of other differences. So compare that with a C trumpet. Wrong period. Sorry about that. I think modern trumpet. Modern trumpet is short, and it has valves. And every time you push one of these valves down, it lengthens the effective tubing. And this allows you to get in a few notes that you wouldn't otherwise have. So I can illustrate this. No valves. Watch. What's the next note I can hit? Trumpet players have to practice about 6 hours a day, by the way. So I have practiced no hours for years. So you'll have to excuse that part. All right, so here's the thing. So with a combination of vowels, you can fill in those gaps between the notes. Perhaps I should explain this a little bit better with an instrument I built. This is a replica of a 1631 German trumpet. And this is pretty authentic in the sense that, though I started out building it with sheet brass, and it took me 4.5 days, working 6 days, 6 hours a day to do it. Nevertheless, it is exactly the same dimensions, more or less, as its original. By the way, at the break, if you want to look at any of these things, you're welcome to come up. No valves, okay? None whatsoever. And a rather different sound. Recognize that. This is hard to play. Like the cornetto, it's very difficult to control. Modern instruments are a lot easier to play than the ancient instruments. This one happens to be in C. The main difference between these two you'll see is the shape of the bell. This is the bell right here. Now, why do these... Oh, I might tune on this just a little bit. This is pitched a note lower. Let me demonstrate something here. The longer the tubing, the easier the, let's see, how to explain this. The longer the tubing, the closer together the notes lie that you can play without valves. So. Until you can get way up high where they all lie together in a smear. And when you, for those of you who read music or know about music, in the upper range, it can go from the third space C in the treble clef up an octave higher and even a little higher in a diatonic scale. So it can go da 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 da. And I wouldn't be able to do that this evening, but the only problem is some of the notes are out of tune. And so you have to constrict your lip muscles. By the way, they say that 200 muscles right here are required to play a trumpet. Can you imagine? That's why you have to practice 6 hours a day. fucked up. Maybe I can explain even further. Look at this. This is an idea I had once to demonstrate the difference. If I get the rubber bands, I'll put them here off. Okay. So this is the kind of thing you see sold as a herald's trumpet. It's really a modern trumpet. There's nothing about it that would be authentic Baroque. Oh, by the way, this one I bought from Germany in 1971. I'd been a professor for about 5 or 6 years, and as a teenager, one of my dreams was somehow to get hold of one of these trumpets. And it took that long. But anyway, all right, here's a, just to show you the difference. Here is a herald trumpet, right? So this is the same length as this. Now I'll have to use this mouthpiece. And let's see. I'm afraid this will fall out of it. Oh yeah, it's okay. Okay. So it sounds like this trumpet. Now I'm going to ask Dr. Maddox to help me out, because we're going to experiment a little bit and see what happens if we lengthen this.
I just have to hold something.
Hold
right?
the bell and make sure it's not pointing at your good ear. Whoops. And let's see. I think I have to stick. Yeah, I have to stick this on to get it far enough out, and then this. Now it's the length of my Baroque trumpet, pretty much. All right, you remember the sound it had before? See how totally different the sound is? It's much richer. I have to make that note up by constricting my lips, because it doesn't exist. And trumpeters in this period, some of them could do pretty amazing things. See, that note is not there. Get. Now, I won't explain why that's so, but anyway. Thank you, sir. You've done a service, if not to music, at least to scientific demonstration. All right, so the trumpets aren't the same. They're harder to play. They are more limited in the notes they can produce, but they were one of the solo instruments that become important in this period. And if I have time, we'll listen to something like that later. Now, let's see.
Lights off?
Nope. Hold on. No. Lights have to stay on. But wait, there's more. So, oddly enough, usually the trumpets don't play with the trombones. Now, a trombone is a bigger trumpet with a slide on it. In other words, you can lengthen and shorten the tubing by moving it in and out. There is a tendency to call the older trombone a sacbut. You say, what? But it comes from a word sacbuté, which means to pull in and out. And to distinguish it from the modern instrument, which we call a trombone, early instrument people tend to call it a sacbut. So the sacbut has narrower tubing than the modern trombone. The bell looks more like this trumpet bell here. It's not as tapered, it's not as flared on the outside, and so on and so forth. Now, I mentioned families, And in some of the videos, they gave you some instances of instrumental families. The main thing to note that starts in this period is that in the Baroque period, you get mixed instruments. And we've already noticed with this breaking up of the choirs of instruments and voices into separate entities, we're already moving in that direction. In the 16th century, generally, instruments were in families. So here's a family. I have to put the family together. This particular family was around throughout the Baroque period. These are, of course, recorders. I'm afraid I don't have my bass recorder anymore. It was the next one down from this tenor recorder. So, this is a sopranino, the sort of piccolo of the family. This is a soprano. This is an alto. This is a tenor, and the bass is about this long. And then there's a contrabass, which is about 8 feet long. And those are pretty expensive. So let's see. I've got a cord of recorders here. The recorder became very popular after a man by the name of Arnold Dolmetsch made the first copy of an ancient instrument around about 1912, I believe it was, somewhere around in there. This is the soprano, and this is the instrument that got adopted a number of decades ago as a school instrument. You can play all kinds of things on these. Now, this is not a, by the way, recorders come in the Renaissance, had a less tapered body, and they couldn't play as high. This little fellow. In the Renaissance, there was one even smaller than this. You can barely get your fingers on the holes. So they're in, this is pitched in F. The soprano is in C. Things start sounding a lot more reasonable. This is the instrument that throughout the Baroque was what people meant by a flute. And this was the solo instrument. And I think you can see why. The sound is more pleasant than the soprano or the sopranino, although Vivaldi wrote some concertos for the sopranino. They're the devil to play, too. They're even hard to play on a modern piccolo. Tenor, which is not usually used as a solo instrument. By the way, the tenor then would be an octave below the soprano. And as you can see, they're just about 2 to 1 in length. That's its highest note. Well, you can get higher, but nobody does that for good reason, too. The lowest note sort of hard to hit. You really have to moderate the pressure that you place on it. Now, when they're played together, of course, they sound sort of like an organ. And so on. It's a lot easier to do with the soprano and the alto. You notice they're named after the voices, of course. And they were thought of as instrumental counterparts of a choir. So on. Okay. Well, what we think of as a flute did exist. It also existed in families. I make these from time to time. The easiest way is just to go to Home Depot and get some PVC pipe and stick a cork in one end and put it on my drill press and drill holes in it. But I've given all those away too. So all I've got to show you is these Chinese flutes. But they're more or less the same thing, except they're made of bamboo. Let's see. What is this? I forget what this is. Got so much stuff, I can't remember what I had. Oh, yeah, this is a smaller Chinese flute. But these are quite simply just a pipe, uniform diameter. There's a hole here. How many have played the flute? Anybody? Applauded? All right, so the cylindrical instrument has a much brighter sound to it. Well, oh, come on, you know. I've got a modern version of one of these. Perhaps it's easier to demonstrate. Well, the fact that there are lots of keys on the on a modern flute is the invention of a man around 1830, Theobald Böhm. He was a jeweler. And it takes that kind of precision to put these keys into place. Let's see, where? There. And I haven't played the flute in a very long time either. So this thing needs to be warmed up. They sound horrible when they're cold, don't they? Tried to play. All right, you hear how bright that is? I'm running out of space. Compare it with its Baroque counterpart. Now, this particular instrument, I mentioned that there were families of instruments, and up and through the 17th century, what you would have heard as a flute would have been like one of these Chinese flutes. That is, a uniform bore all the way through, and a that was about a B flat. Okay. So this is a Baroque flute. There's only one key here, and it was added. There are no keys on these flutes, nor were there on Renaissance flutes. And this kind of flute was invented by a French flute maker or flute makers around about 1690, so towards the end of the 17th century. And what they discovered was that they could make the instrument in better tune by tapering it like a recorder. Oh, recorder means to record is an archaic English word that means to warble. That's why they're called recorders. But during the period, they called them flutes. See, it's not as bright as the modern metal instrument, and the fact that it has only one key means that it, to keep certain notes in tune, you either have to use what they call cross-fingering, you do this on the recorder as well, or, I'll give you a demonstration, this instrument is pitched in D, which was the typical key of the normal flute, and after this flute then came into being, it became more or less the standard solo instrument in the high Baroque, so at the time of Bach. But these instruments coexisted with the recorders throughout the period, and in fact, Georg Philipp Telemann even wrote a piece that uses flute solo and recorder solo. It was quite a lot of fun to play, actually. A little flat, that F sharp. Now you can produce an F by covering this hole. Like so. Well, what do you do if you have to play an F sharp? And here's what they did. You had to tip it out. So it's another demonstration of the very simple fact that there were all kinds of things you had to do in this period to make an instrument sound right. And it sort of gets worse, too, because they didn't have a uniform pitch. They didn't have A440. They went from one town to another, and the instruments were all pitched differently. I don't know how they managed, really. Plus, in the case of other instruments, you had to sometimes add joints and subtract joints and do all sorts of things, and that throws the tuning of the instrument off. So, very difficult. You get a lot of respect for Baroque musicians when you played around with these instruments. Now, around the end of the 17th century, the hunting horn begins to enter into serious music. The hunting horn is just a signaling device, really, and it's used, as you might expect, for the hunt. This is a trompe de chasse. It's a 20th century instrument. It's really dusty, too. I loaned it out one or two times, and it suffered some dents. This instrument is exactly twice the length of the trumpet. And if you've ever played a horn, you know that the notes lie even closer together. And it's quite difficult to control, too. Horn players, by the way, specialize in different ranges, and they use different mouthpieces. This is a ferocious mouthpiece. It has a sharp edge around, and it's very hard to control up in the high register. Oof. So, after the Baroque period, guess what they discovered? This is not part of the Baroque period. Before they put vowels on these things, somebody figured out that you could lower a note by sticking your fist in it. In the Baroque period, they played it this way. But later on, they realized if you held it like this, you could drop it a note. Now, of course, it sounds more muffled, but you get the note in. And so on. That was called stopping, and all of Mozart's horn concertos and all of Beethoven's horn parts, so well into the early 19th century, they were all written for the hand horn, as it was called. And then around 1830, when they developed valves, the horn sounded uniform over its whole range. But in this period, the horn is supposed to sound muffled on certain notes. And when they introduced the valve horns in the 1830s, people didn't like them at first. They said, that doesn't sound right. Ah, perfection, you know, it comes at a price. Last couple of things. During the Renaissance, there was a family of instruments called usually crumb horns, and there are a bunch of different ones in this family with different names. This is a jolly little instrument. It's called a courtholt, and it's got a whole lot of holes. And that's because you notice there's no hole in the end. So I had to put the hole somewhere else. And that's because the music goes down and around and it comes out here. Now you may wonder what makes the sound. You have to cover this hole with this part of your finger. This is sort of like the bassoon. In fact, if I take this cap off, behold, a bassoon reed of sort. K-O-R-T-H-O-L-T, which means short wood, because this is actually playing sounds that are twice as long as its length. Its acoustic length is twice as long, and that's because there's a thin bore that goes down here and then loops around and comes back out, and the actual end here is where the sound comes out. Well, the crumb horns, so-called, in French, courmorne, crumb from curved, a curved horn. It looks like an umbrella handle, and that was another member of this capped reed family. So there's a cap over the reed. That means that you can't produce higher notes by clamping down the reed the way you can with an oboe. Now that I mentioned oboe, the oboe developed from an instrument that was very prevalent in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance called a shawm, which is a very loud oboe, as it were. It's played with a double reed, like that thing, except you put it in your mouth. The shawms became less and less popular in the course of the 17th century until French makers created the modern oboe. And oboe is just French au bois, or high wood. And so the oboe becomes an important solo instrument in the course of the Baroque. So you have the recorder, the trumpet, the oboe, the flute, and above all, the violin. And this is the period in which the violin then first emerges as the most important orchestral instrument. This instrument never really was much written for during the Baroque, but it did get to be an important instrument in the classical period. This is looks like a small clarinet. It's actually called a chalumeau. It's a single reed instrument, and the reed needs to be wetter so it's more flexible. You have to soak this a little bit before you can play it. There's no way I'm going to do that right now. But anyway, it turns into the clarinet, in Mozart's time. It was new then. There are few, there almost nothing in the way of music for the Chalumeau, although Telemann, contemporary of Bach, and a famous composer in his own right, did write a piece for two Chalumeau, but Telemann had a music journal, and he would write music for all kinds of combinations of instruments because people played them and they didn't have anything to play. Well, finally, the violin family. During this period, during the 16th century, the family of stringed instruments were viols. And if I get a chance, I'll show you a picture of this, but even though the smallest one is the size of a violin, it's not played this way. That was called a viol da braccia, or an arm viol. They're played like this, like a cello. And where you play a modern violin or violin overhand, you hold the bow like this. With a viol, you held it like this, underhand. The viols had frets on them, like a guitar, and gut strings, frets, and they had usually five strings. And they came in very different sizes. The tenor of the family, they're called viol de gambas because you held them between your legs or on your lap, and gamba meaning leg in Italian. The viol da gamba continued in use all the way up through the mid-18th century, and then it died out. The others were replaced by the violin family. The violin was really pretty much before 1550 or so a peasant instrument, kind of a leftover medieval instrument. It got redesigned by the Stradivari and others, and it turned into the king of solo instruments, and its cousins, the viola, which is the alto of the family, and the cello, the violoncello, which in Italian means the big violin, and the bass, then became the family that persisted in the modern orchestra. And in the course of the Baroque, then, it is this string group that becomes the backbone of the orchestra. Well, that's enough of that. Let's take a break.
I just turned this off. Is that all right?
That is very good.